This is 4:55 on Monday, August 31st. Wednesday, August 31st. Things.
Oh my God.
Okay, so good morning. A happy Wednesday. A couple of logistical things. Where is it? Here, I think. I decided to change my office hours. They were, I think, 3 to 4. I changed them to 3:30 to 4:30. This has two, or maybe they were 2 to 3. Anyway, I changed them to 3:30 to 4:30, Wednesdays and Thursdays. This has the effect of hitting at least two class periods, so maybe people don't get locked out. And also, our TA has finally been decided. Her name is Kadrut Kaur, is how you say her last name, Kadrut. And she's going to have office hours as well, and she will have hers on Mondays and Wednesdays from 2 to 3 in ETRL 309. Does everybody know where the ETRL building is?
Yeah.
You go down the hall and go over the bridge and you get there. All right, so she'll be around during that time as well. And 309 is sort of the first major room to the left after you cross the bridge. Easy to find. Any questions about logistics? Figures? All right. Okay, so today we're going to start with some clicks stuff. Get a better mouse here. And what we're going to start with is related to a question that has come up. Oh dear, that's awfully small. That has come up relating to the homework a couple of times, and it comes up frequently year after year. So we'll just sort of work through some of these issues. So it's related to this question about what is the width of a bit on the wire, and let's just make a picture about that. To sort of get a sense of what I mean there. So I've got a wire, and think of like a telegraph key sending at this end of the wire. Electric circuits, sending at that end of the wire. When I close the telegraph key, the voltage here goes from zero up to whatever the voltage of the battery is, but that happens at the left side of the wire, right? And it will take a certain amount of time for this step in the voltage to propagate down the wire. Meanwhile, I may have opened the telegraph key, and now I have a zero propagating down the wire, and then sometime later I'll close it. And so you see, as they're propagating down the wire, there's a distance between those things. And if we think about this as sending bits as opposed to sending keystrokes of a telegraph key, we're going to see that between every after I send a bit, that bit is going to start going, and then it's going to be some time before I start sending the next bit. And what I mean by the width of the bit is that distance. Okay. So with that as background, let us turn to the clicks questions. So, I'm asking about the width of the bit on the wire. What units should the answer have? That's your first.
Meters per bit.
So just answer here. I'm getting answers sort of all over the place. Just like most widths, this one is measured in meters, right? Or meters per bit, if you want to really sort of work it out, because we're going to have multiple bits on the wire and each one is going to have a certain width. So we'll say the units here are meters per bit. Would be the appropriate answer. Next question. So, I want to know the width of the bit on the wire. What formula for the answer, given that the that what I gave you was R, the rate for sending, measured in bits per second, right? And I gave you S, the speed by which the signals propagate on the wire in meters per second. So what is the formula for the width of a bit given R and S? It's easy to get mixed up here, so pay attention to the units in the unit analysis. That's the transmission rate, R, yes. W equals S meters per second helps to write in the units. S meters per second divided by R bits per second. Okay? So when you do that calculation with the units, the seconds go away and we're left with meters per bit. So don't get it mixed up. It's not R over S. It's S over R. If you do R over S, the units are messed up. Okay, so what's the numerical answer with units? Now I'm going to challenge. This is going to challenge your arithmetic. Oh, the notation here is one that I should clarify. The little caret here means 10 to the 8th power. Sometimes I may use a asterisk to mean the same thing, depending on which programming language I've been using most recently. Oh, get the units right. Somebody just gave an answer of 20 bits per meter. Right? The width doesn't have that unit. It has the unit meters per bit. Get the units right. So, I get different answers. They all mostly suggest the right process and bad arithmetic. So let's see if I can do this. We have 2 times 10 to the 8th meters per second divided by 10 times 10 to the 6th bits per second is equal to 2 over 10 times 10 squared, 10 times 10 squared meters per bit is equal to 20 meters per bit. Okay? That would be a good answer. 20. Okay? Again, somebody gave an answer 0.05. That suggests that you've got the problem upside down somehow. Watch out for the units. Don't get confused by that. All right. Question?
Does that mean there's a 20-meter spacing between each bit?
Well, it means somehow that between the bit itself and the other stuff that goes with it, if there's framing that goes with it, it all takes up 20 meters. Think of it as the distance between the start of one bit and the start of the next bit, and you don't really care much about what happens in between. Yeah, question?
Why would we want to know this?
We're going to go on to that question right now. Okay? So, next step. If the link is D equals 100 kilometers long, how many bits are simultaneously in flight? So how many of our 20-meter bits will fit on a 100-kilometer-long link? Okay, pay attention to the scale multipliers here. The link is 100 kilometers, and the bits are 20 meters. Somebody may want to revise their answer. Okay, good. It's 100 kilometers divided by 20 meters is equal to 100 over 20 kilometers equals 100 over 20 bits. I've been saying 20 meters per bit is equal to 100 over 20 bits times 1,000 is equal to 5,000 bits. Okay? Or 1 kilobit, if you want. All right? Now we can answer the question, why did we care about that other thing? We cared about that other thing because what we really care about is how many bits fit on the wire. And the reason we care how many bits fit on the wire is because if the sender has to somehow respond to something that happens at the receiver, that is, the receiver is going to send something back, we need to know, for many purposes, and talk about this multiple times during class, we need to know for many purposes how much after how many bits after sending something will the sender actually be able to respond to what the receiver did? And that really involves not just the number of bits that fit on the wire in one direction, but the actual whole round trip time. And so I think in the homework I ask you to sort of rearrange all these terms into something called the bandwidth delay product. And you're going to do that by taking your R and your S and your D and sort of arranging them and seeing that the product of the bandwidth R and the delay, the propagation delay, which is D over S, the product of those two things is this number, a number of bits, and that's what we're going to want to know. Okay? So that's why the homework asks about all that. That's why we went through this whole exercise today. Understanding conceptually what it means for a bit to have width on the wire. Okay? Cool. I think that is where we will stop with the questions for the time being, and maybe come back later and maybe not, depending on how far we get. All right. So, delay, loss, and throughput, that's sort of what we've been working on here. We're going to move on and talk about protocols and protocol layers and why we do that. So, we talked about the idea of a protocol, the rules by which different people talk to each other in networks, and we sort of observed that there are protocols floating around all over the place in this picture. And an approach to understanding the complexity of all this arose in the late 1980s called layering the protocols. And the goal of that exercise was to be able to understand the complexity associated with all of this stuff that goes into networking. So we've got hosts, routers, a whole bunch of different ways to send things. We've got wires and fiber optics and coaxial cables and radio waves and all that stuff. We've got web applications and email applications and file transfer applications, blah, blah, blah. Okay? So the idea of this layering of protocols is intended to help organize all of that stuff in a way that's a little easier to understand. Now, in the slides, he goes through sort of organizing air travel in this way. I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to skip over that. You can go back and look at it in the book. So in networking, what we do is we structure our protocols in layers, and then we talk about that structure itself rather than as the layered protocol. And that forms what we call our reference model for discussion. It also turns out to be a reference model or guide to the way that you implement protocols. You have one protocol layer talking to another protocol layer and so on and so forth. We'll see pictures of this in a second. Now, it also turns out that if you sort of religiously obey the protocol layering in your implementation, you'll be faced with certainly some inefficiencies, and occasionally you'll be faced with some impossibilities, because it turns out that occasionally you want to do things where one protocol layer needs to know from another protocol layer that isn't really defined to be exposed. But that's sort of more for the graduate course, I would say. All right, so layered protocols lead to what we call a protocol stack. And the protocol stack that's used in the internet consists of five layers. There's the application layer, which is where we find protocols like email, web, voice over IP, applications. The things that we're actually trying to get done. We'll start in this course by looking at application layer protocols. Below the application layer, and this will be the subject of chapter 3, so application layer is chapter 2. Chapter 3 is what are called transport protocols. And transport protocols are about the delivery of data from one process in one computer to a different process in another computer. Right? So our applications and servers are implemented as processes within the operating system, and transport layer is about getting messages from process to process. Below the transport layer, and this will be chapter 4, is the network layer. And the whole job of the network layer is to get packets or datagrams from one host to another host. So what's the difference between the transport layer and the network layer that we could see already? That there's more addressing associated with the transport layer than there is with the network layer, because we have to do a finer grain thing. We have to, having gotten a message out of host, we have to deliver it to the correct process. So that's one difference. Turns out that there are other differences as well that we'll save for a little bit later. The link layer is about the rules for transferring data from one host to another host on the same link. So the network layer is from one host anywhere in the internet to another host anywhere else in the internet. The link layer is about sort of adjacent hosts that you can reach by one hop. And in the link layer, we find another kind of addressing, we'll talk about when we get there. And we also sometimes find things about reliability of data transfer. We'll see reliability in several places, but that's something that's implemented there. It's sort of the philosophy in the internet is, if I send you a message and it's been corrupted, you should ignore it. So figuring out whether a message has been corrupted at the link layer is a good thing. For link layers that are sort of really noisy, that is, they tend to corrupt packets a lot, we'll use coding techniques to actually recover from those errors and deliver the message anyway. But the point is, all the upper layers are oblivious to everything going on at that layer as far as detecting and correcting errors. And finally, there's sort of the physical layer, which we usually think of as, you know, depends on where you're working. When you're standing up at the application layer, the physical layer can usually be thought of as just sort of being combined with the link layer. If you're engineering link layers, or physical layers and link layers, then you have to worry about the physical things, like exactly how is the light coupled in fiber optic cable, exactly what voltage should be used to represent the signal on a wire, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so we're mostly not going to worry about the physical layer in this class, except to recognize that it's the basis on which all else depends. Okay, so that five-layer model is what's known as the Internet Protocol Stack. The actual intellectual work that led to this layered model happened in a slightly different context called the International Standards Organization Open International Open Systems Interconnection Reference Model. Thank you, Open Systems. ISO OSI. It was a seven-layer model, and you'll recognize some of the layers from the internet. Physical link, network transport, no presentation and no session in the internet. And those additional layers do things like allowing sessions within a communication to be recovered if something goes wrong. Like I said, in the internet, if something goes wrong, we tend to just bail and start over again. And also, the presentation layer has things to do like what order do the bytes come in, what order do the bits come in. In the internet, they just decided that these were complications that were mostly unnecessary to be standardized at this level, and so they just pushed any of those issues up into the application. So if you have concerns about those things in the internet, then you have to deal with them in the application, and there's no provided service that does that. Okay, so now thinking about this from an implementation perspective, what we have is running in the end hosts of the computers, we have code or circuitry that implements each of these different layers. In the interior of the network, the switches and routers don't implement all of the layers. A switch only implements the physical and linker, and a router implements the network layer as well. But at the endpoints, we have all five layers. And let's see what happens to a message that starts out at the application and gets sent. Our picture is that the message is being sent down through the layers at the source. It gets passed off to here, and then it gets delivered up through the layers at the destination. So we pass the message down to the transport layer, and the transport layer needs some additional data to communicate with the transport layer at the other side. So it adds what's called a transport header to the message as passed from the application. Think of these layers as communicating with their counterparts wherever they are. So this transport layer is really communicating with this transport layer. This application is communicating with this application. This link layer is communicating with this link layer. And this network layer is communicating with this network layer. Okay.
So we add a header for the transport, pass it to the network, add a header for the network, pass it to the link, add a header for the link, and then typically the physical thing doesn't put a header on. Gets delivered there. All right.
Now, when it reaches this network layer, the network header may change between here and here because something may have happened. They're communicating with each other. Maybe not. Doesn't necessarily happen. But what you know is that the transport layer and the message won't get changed when this network layer processes the message, because it's only really talking to the network layer, but it doesn't care about what.
And then it gets passed over here. The headers get stripped off as the message comes up, and ultimately the application gets the message.
Now, of course, the application itself may have its own headers, but the network model doesn't really tell us about that. That's up to the application layer protocol whether it has its own headers.
Okay, so when we get to Chapter 2, which we'll do in just a few minutes, we will start looking at the application layer and how application layers use the services of the operating system in order to send and receive messages, and also what the structure of those application protocols are.
Before we get there, however, I want to say just a word about security, and sort of how we got to be in such a mess with respect to security and the internet. So the field of security is really about how do we as users of networks and applications and so forth go about doing our business without interference from other people, whether that interference is in the form of corruption of our messages or theft of our messages, theft of information from our messages, or just our ability to use the network itself, right? One of the attacks that somebody may do on us is just try to prevent us from using the network. That's called a denial of us attack. So we're interested in how to protect ourselves against those things and how to prevent them from happening. The attackers are interested in figuring out ways to take what's there and do whatever it is that they want to do. One of the challenges with students working in networking and even working in security is getting them to think like attackers. Not to be attackers, but to think like attackers. It's so easy to think, oh, I put this fix in place and nobody will be able to do that to me. Well, fine, they won't be able to do that to you, but what else will they be able to do to you? Also, to think like attackers as having multiple motivations. Right? Some attackers may indeed want to steal your credit card information. Other attackers may want to encrypt the files on your computer and charge you a ransom for getting them back. People will do these things. Okay, so how did we get into this awful situation where you read about these things at least every week, if not every day, happening to other people, hopefully, and maybe sometimes to ourselves? The internet was originally not really designed with security in mind. It was a small system for sort of at most a few hundred institutions and a few thousand users who were all sort of researchers in a community. They were part of a community or parts of communities where standards of behavior were expected of them. All these protocols were not designed with 6 billion people on the planet using them. And if you think about 6 billion people and you think about even 1% being criminally inclined, which is probably a low estimate, especially over a lifetime, but at any given time, 1% of 6 billion is 6 billion is 6 times 10 to the 9th, so 1% is 6 times 10 to the 7th. 60 million people, right, at any given time are out there and they're after you. Right? You're not paranoid if they're actually after you. Okay. So what can they do? We talk about virus and worms, spyware, denial of service. This is a classic. Attack a whole bunch, sort of get into a whole bunch of computers around the network. And, well, at least you take over thousands of machines at once. And start blasting traffic at the poor guy who's trying to get something done. Sniffing, which is essentially looking at packets in flight, seeing what they do. We're going to talk about Wireshark later. I'll just say now that this is a useful tool, but you must use it with extreme care, especially on WSU's networks if they figure out that you're doing that and they don't realize, well, if they have a wrong impression about why you're doing it, there's potentially big trouble there. So when we use Wireshark, we'll confine it to just looking at things that our own cursor are doing rather than.
Faking it, pretending to be somebody you're not. That's a good one. And we have a whole chapter about security later. All right, so I'm not going to go through the history slides, but they're interesting, so just take a look at them and take a look at the relevant part of the book. It helps to explain, the history helps to explain how we got where we are today. So, take one.
Transport layer, talk about congestion control, we'll come back to this one. This is a classic incident of use of a network getting ahead of the research. One day in 1988, nobody could do anything on the internet as it was then. Break another computer.
Nobody could do anything. And no matter what they did, they couldn't get out of the state of not being able to do anything. Bits just wouldn't go from A to B. And ultimately they realized that the reason bits wouldn't go from A to B was the paths from A to B and A to everywhere else were occupied with traffic that was accomplishing absolutely nothing. It's called a congestion collapse of the network. And the only solution was to turn everything off and start over again. Can you imagine today having to do that? In 1988 you could do that, but you couldn't do that today.
Well, it turns out some very brilliant people at Lawrence Berkeley Lab figured out a way to design what's called congestion control algorithm that will respond appropriately to prevent congestion collapse. And so that has been part of the network ever since. And so on and so forth. Okay, and the review.
All right, any questions about any of this? So your homework is largely about the performance aspects of this. That's fine. And I think now that you understand with the bits, everything in the homework should be pretty straightforward.
Yeah. Is there any new way to build, like, implement new protocols?
Oh, all the time. All the time.
Because I like, look at that and I see like all the protocols all the time.
Right. So some of the protocols like TCP and UDP and IP are sort of so fundamental to everything that they just get used continuously. Everybody uses them. But even at those fundamental layers, network and transport layers, protocols do get changed. So IP, the Internet Protocol, the network layer protocol that we all use today, mostly, is called version 4 of IP. But version 6 has been defined for about almost 20 years now, and someday we are going to switch to using IP version 6. Instead of IP version 4. And it's just very slowly happening. TCP and UDP, the transport layer protocols that are most commonly used, there are others. There's something called SCTP that is kind of a combination of TCP and UDP that has some nice properties. You can use that. It's implemented in most operating systems. We just mostly don't use it. Think about it, we're so used to using the other ones. At the application layer, new protocols are invented all the time, and when you do your first project homework, we're going to use a made-up application layer. You can make up your own. Nobody will prevent you from doing that. Okay? So, yes. New protocols all the time. New link layer protocols when new kinds of link layer technology are invented. For example, wireless LANs, 802.11 phase wireless LANs, keep getting invented all the time. And so we have B, G, and A, and N, and I, and all those. They're all different protocols. And they happen through standardization. Other questions? Yeah.
Would Bluetooth be considered a wireless protocol?
Bluetooth is a wireless protocol. It's a link layer protocol. And there are... It's not a very good link layer protocol in some ways. It has hard to fix security problems, and it uses such small segments that mapping the internet onto it is a bit problematic, but it can be done. Yeah.
So for the Wi-Fi, the A, B, G, and so forth, isn't that more like physical properties instead of software properties?
It's both. It's actually both. Yeah. Which is why it is often so hard to get laptops to connect to different different wireless access points. Yeah. Many of them just work fine, and then you run into problems. Yeah. WSUs has been at various times very problematic, and other times pretty okay. And right now it seems to be pretty okay to get connections pretty easily. But one year I was teaching in the room across the hall, and my laptop would not connect to the access point when I was in the room. I had to go out in the hall, and then it would connect, and then I could go back in the room and use it fine. Yeah. And it wasn't a matter of signal strength. I mean, there was plenty of signal strength. It was, who knows what it was. It's so complicated. So, yeah.
Okay. Escape. Let's just get started with chapter 2.
So chapter 2 is about the application layer, and now we see why the name of this book is Computer Networking, a Top-Down Approach. Think about that stack of layers, and think about the order in which we're going to do them. We're going to do application, transport, network, link. Okay? So that's why it's called a top-down approach. There are other textbooks that think that the way to present this to students is to build it up from the bottom. Talk about the physical and the link layer first. This book does it this way. And it turns out that the book is not too bad for doing it the other way around either. I just, in another class, I start with chapter 6 and work my way back to chapter 2. But for this class, it works well to do it in this order. Okay, so we're going to talk about network applications. We're going to talk about specific protocols. We'll talk about the web and HTTP. We're going to skip FTP because nobody should use FTP, and people should stop using FTP if they're using it. So we won't talk about it.
Right?
Why is that? Because FTP is fundamentally insecure in the sense that if you use FTP, you type in your password and it goes out over the internet. So that's really quite easy.
You can use it on a local network that's wired.
If anybody else is on that local network who can sniff your packets, they can still see your password. I would only use FTP in a situation where a password was not ever going to be seen. There's so-called anonymous FTP where that's possible. Right. Yes? Oh, so SFTP is a different protocol than FTP. It's secure FTP, and it's actually based on something we'll talk about called the transport layer security, model, which is it, but it's different, and and the details of it are quite different from FTP. Yeah. So, anyway, so we'll skip FTP, but we will talk about mail, we'll talk about something called the domain name service, and then we will get to talking about actually programming with writing programs that use the network from the application layer. And that's called socket programming, and you have your other book that's called Socket Programming in C that will turn at that point. Okay? So that's the plan. Okay, so here's the again, it's worth keeping in mind sort of what a revolution this network stuff is. We can write programs that communicate with each other over the whole wide world and really don't need to know anything about what's happening in the network core. We write our applications without regard to the network core. We don't have to write any code to run on the network core. We're just writing code for the end system. That's the revolution that took place when the internet came about in the late 1980s. Okay, so once again, we really want to talk to each other. What does that mean? Oh, we can talk anywhere in the network, I guess. Okay, applications. There's a really common structure of applications called client-server, and we'll talk about what that means in just a second here. That's sort of the most common one that we see. Peer-to-peer architecture is more complicated, but also what's called more scalable, because as new players come into using the application, more resources come along with them. And so various versions of Skype have actually taken advantage of this and caused some controversy in the sense that if you were using Skype, other people might have been using your computer to support their conversations while you were having yours as well. Okay. But those resources come along with a peer-to-peer application. So the client-server architecture is one in which there's a server that is usually sort of always on, or at least always find your whole account, and it has a permanent address. We always know where it's going to be. And again, permanent in a sort of temporary sense. It can be changed. It just has some things have to be different. And servers are usually that we use a lot are usually put in data centers where the power can be managed and they can be packed in small spaces. Clients, on the other hand, are the things like our laptops and phones and so forth that wander around. They may be connected at various times and maybe not connected. They may have different addresses at different times. We don't care. And they typically do not communicate directly with one another, although sort of mixed peer-to-peer and client-server schemes exist where you may use a client-server scheme to figure out about your peers and then communicate directly with them. So BitTorrent, for example, is an example of a system that works that way, where there are some things that are servers and some things are done with servers and some things are done through peer-to-peer style. So the idea is that the client contact servers because the servers have addresses that can be figured out, and you're used to this, right? When you type something into your web browser, you type in
the address of www.google.com, and your computer goes off and contacts Google. Google doesn't contact you. It would have no idea that you wanted to talk to it until you talked to it first. Okay, so we'll go on from here next time, and take us another couple lectures to get to the programming part.